Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 36 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 42, and it will be mostly sunny this Wednesday, January 6, 2021. And you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI New York. Coming up next, A New Day. This morning, we celebrate the victory of Democrat Raphael Warnock, who won one of Georgia's two Senate runoffs Wednesday, January 5th, becoming the first black senator in his state's history. The focus now shifts to the second race between Perdue and Democrat John Ossoff, which is too early to call as votes are still being counted. But Ossoff is on the doorstep to victory, putting the Senate majority within the Democrats' reach. Also this morning, a joint session of Congress gets ready to certify the votes of the Electoral College, the final arbiters of Joe Biden's win to the presidency of the United States. This at the same time that Trump rallies his supporters in D.C. to protest the election result. We talked to Professor Douglas Medina, instructor of political and social sciences at Gutman Community College, to help us understand this strange political moment, an historic one. Stay tuned for headlines. And this is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. The United States has reached the worst stage of the pandemic to date, with the deadly results of holiday gatherings yet to arrive. As of this week, the U.S. states with the largest share of COVID-19 hospitalizations are largely concentrated in the South and in the West. And they are Arizona, Nevada, Alabama, California, Georgia, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Texas, and Delaware. Hospitals across Los Angeles County are preparing to ration care and prioritize treating patients who are most likely to survive, a dire but necessary step as coronavirus continues to spread widely in Southern California. This in a country with lower bed-to-patient ratios than most of the Western world, even before the pandemic. Let's listen to LA County Board of Supervisors Hilda Solis.
Over the weekend, we reached over 800,000 total cases in Los Angeles County. It took 10 months to hit 400,000 cases, but we have reached another 400,000 within the last month alone. That is a human disaster and one that was avoidable. But I need to underscore that it could be worse. The situation is already beyond our imagination. But it could become beyond comprehension if the health restrictions in place are not fully obeyed. We have over 7,600 people in our hospitals from COVID-19. It is getting harder and harder for healthcare workers to care for those coming to the hospital with gunshot wounds, heart attacks, strokes, and injuries from car accidents. Hospitals are declaring internal disasters and having to open church gyms to serve as hospital units.
And the new and more infectious COVID-19 variant has appeared in 5 U.S. states: California, New York, Florida, Colorado, and Georgia. As coronavirus continues to spread widely in Southern California, and public health experts expect it to be identified in more states in the coming days. And Tuesday afternoon, Trump supporters, bundled against the cold but free of masks, arrived in downtown Washington for what they see as a last stand for Trump, who has continued to falsely assert that the election was stolen from him. Many Republican lawmakers, all 10 living former defense secretaries, and numerous elected officials across the nation have said Trump should stop attempting to overturn the results of the election, and that his refusal to do so has only energized his followers. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has mobilized the National Guard and ordered every city police officer to be on duty Tuesday and Wednesday to handle protests of the election, which the mayor said, quote, may include people looking to instigate violence, unquote. One Wednesday demonstration has a D.C. National Park Service permit for up to 30,000 people. Trump said on Twitter that he will speak at 11 a.m. Wednesday. On Tuesday, Trump praised those protesters who were echoing his conspiracy theories in the streets. Members of right-wing groups have taken to social media, such as Parler and Telegram, to discuss how to bring guns into the district despite laws banning open carry throughout the city and prohibiting guns on federal lands such as the Mall and Freedom Plaza, or anywhere within 1,000 feet of a protest. And black and white activists are now protecting the Black Lives Matter Plaza memorials. These guardians are preparing for today's pro-Trump protest. And two anti-Trump activists in particular have caught the attention of the media. They sleep through freezing rain in the shadow of the White House under the cover of a solitary tent, and they are protecting thousands of Black Lives Matter photos, signs, and mementos, marking the focal point of a fortress fence at Black Lives Matter Plaza. The two friends, Nadine Saylor, and who's from Waldorf, Maryland, and Karen Irwin, from right here in New York City, Hell's Kitchen, are now known as the guardians of the Black Lives Matter Plaza memorials, watching for far-right vandals who ebb and flow with pro-Trump demonstrations. Here's Black Lives Matter Plaza guardian Nadine Saylor.
I have made a decision that I am not going to let them come into D.C. and intimidate me. They have made Black Lives Matter Plaza on this fence their focal point to destroy in his name, and I am not going to allow that. I am not allowing them to win, because if I am intimidated and stay away, they win.
And you might have heard that more than 400 Google engineers and other workers have formed a union, capping years of growing activism at one of the world's largest companies and presenting a rare beachhead for labor organizers in staunchly anti-union Silicon Valley. The group revealed their efforts on Monday. The union's creation is highly unusual for the tech industry, which has long resisted efforts to organize its largely white-collar workforce. It follows increasing demands by employees at Google, for policy overhauls on pay, harassment, and ethics, and is likely to escalate tensions with top leadership. The new union, called the Alphabet Workers Union, after Google's parent company, Alphabet, was organized in secret for the better part of a year and elected its leadership last month. The group is affiliated with the Communications Workers of America, a union that represents workers in telecommunications and media in the United States and Canada. But unlike a traditional union, which demands that an employer come to the bargaining table to agree on a contract, the Alphabet Workers Union is a so-called minority union that represents a fraction of the company's more than 200,000 full-time employees and contractors. Workers said it was primarily an effort to give structure and longevity for activism at Google rather than to negotiate for a contract. Chewy Shaw, an engineer at Google in San Francisco Bay Area and the vice chair of the union's leadership council, said the union was a necessary tool to sustain pressure on management so that workers could force changes on workplace issues. He said, quote, "Our goals go beyond the workplace questions of are people getting paid enough. Our issues are going much broader. It is a time where a union is an answer to these problems."
It really hit a point for us where the structures that we have are not really protecting the workers who are really speaking up for those who need it. And so we found that at this point we needed to really start coming together and figure out if there's a structure that we could build. From the women's walkout, that was a big moment for a number of us because that was when we had a large number of employees all come together, make it clear that we wanted change to happen, only to see most of our demands ignored. Having the Thanksgiving 4 firings, along with the firing that continued that the next month, just was another example of the executives just focusing on ways of silencing the problem rather than actually addressing it. It really became the time when we needed to start figuring out how we can do this, and we started working with the CWA. And since then, they've been working alongside us, really making it clear that they see this as a worker-driven project.
And that's Chewy Shaw, who's one of the representatives of the new union recently launched at Google. The new union is the clearest sign of how thoroughly employee activism has swept through Silicon Valley over the past few years. While software engineers and other tech workers largely kept quiet in the past on societal and political issues, employees at Amazon, Salesforce, Pinterest, and others have become more vocal on matters like diversity, pay discrimination, and sexual harassment. And this is a very important development, folks. The fact that these white-collar workers are forming a union. This is a rare thing, rarely seen in American history. And given that the character of the labor force has changed since the 1930s, the high tide of unionization efforts in the United States, from industry to service, this is perhaps an entry or an inspiration or sets an example for other white-collar workers to follow. And what's important about this is that they're saying, folks, this is not just about wages. This is about how we organize the workplace, which, folks, is the beginning of the struggle to take back the means of production and reorganize it in the interest of human need. I'll remind you that back at the height of the pandemic here in New York City, GM workers, not GM, GE workers, General Electric workers, had a protest up in Massachusetts demanding that the government and GE work together to reorganize production to make the apparatuses we need for the pandemic. What do you call them? The the things that help people breathe. Not PEs, but the masks, not the big masks that help people breathe in the ICU, which are made by GE. I'm sure someone is Michael. Marcos. What am I thinking about? The apparatuses that we need to survive when you can't. Ventilators, Lord Jesus, ventilators. So this happened at the height of the pandemic. There were no ventilators. There was a debate about whether to reorganize production, which the president can do, and does often when there's a military need, which is all the time in the United States because our military budget is so high. So there was a debate about whether to reorganize the economy to make ventilators. And GE workers were like, hell yeah, we make them. And why aren't we? So this struggle has the potential. Everything is potential to ignite a different kind of labor struggle in the United States that goes beyond bread and butter issues, as important as those are. When you start talking about what are we producing and to what end, that is a political strike historically that we see usually on the way to revolution. And it's 717 and 36 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
I was not ready the day you gave me your heart. I was still falling apart. But since that moment, can't stop hearing your name. Wondering about you always. Come back, Georgia, come back. Come back, Georgia, come back. I just need another chance. To make it better. Come back, Georgia, come back. Come back, Georgia, come back. I just need another chance. Chance to make it better. I was unhappy the day you left out my. Just feeling unsure. So long I've missed you. Now I can honestly say I'm ready to love you always. Come back, Georgia, come back.
That was Georgia by Emily King, and we thank Ellis Maxwell for choosing that very appropriate song for the conversation we're about to have. Today, January 6th, is an important day for electoral politics. The votes of the Georgia senatorial runoff election are in, at least one of them. This morning, we celebrate the victory of Democrat Raphael Warnock, who won one of Georgia's two Senate runoffs Wednesday, becoming the first black senator in his state's history. The focus now shifts to the second race between David Perdue and Democrat John Ossoff, which is too early to call as votes are still being counted. But Ossoff is on the doorstep to victory, putting the Senate majority within the Democrats' reach. Let's listen to Raphael Warnock's victory speech.
I come before you tonight as a proud American and as a son of Georgia. My roots are planted deeply in Georgia soil. A child who grew up in the Caton Homes housing projects of Savannah, Georgia. Number 11 out of 12 children. A proud graduate of Morehouse College and the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, the spiritual home of Martin Luther King Jr. and Congressman John Lewis. A son of my late father, who was a pastor, a veteran, and a small businessman. And my mother, who as a teenager growing up in Waycross, Georgia, used to pick somebody else's cotton. But the other day, because this is America, the 82-year-old hands that used to pick somebody else's cotton went to the polls and picked her youngest son to be a United States senator. So I come before you tonight as a man who knows that the improbable journey that led me to this place in this historic moment in America could only happen here. We were told that we couldn't win this election. But tonight, we prove that with hope, hard work, and the people by our side, anything is possible. May my story be an inspiration to some young person who is trying to grasp and grab hold of the American dream. And so, Georgia, I am honored by the faith that you have shown in me. And I promise you this tonight. I am going to the Senate to work for all of Georgia. No matter who you cast your vote for in this election, in this moment in American history, Washington has a choice to make. In fact, all of us have a choice to make. Will we continue to divide, distract, and dishonor one another? Or will we love our neighbors as we love ourselves? Will we play political games while real people suffer? Or will we win righteous fights together, standing shoulder to shoulder, for the good of Georgia, for the good of our country? Will we seek to destroy one another as enemies or heed the call towards the common good, building together what Dr. King called the beloved community? Here's what I know. I know that we can beat this pandemic with science and good old-fashioned common sense. I know we can rebuild a fairer economy by respecting the dignity of work and the workers who do it. An economy that honors those whom we now call essential workers by paying them an essential wage and providing for them essential benefits. In the words of Dr. King, who grew up just a few blocks from where I'm sitting right now, we are tied in a single garment of destiny. We are caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I remember my dad in this moment. He used to wake me up every morning at dawn. It was morning, but it was still dark. It's dark right now, but morning comes.
And that was Raphael Warnock, who just won Georgia's Senate runoff. And he's the first black senator in the state of Georgia to be elected. And I'd like to thank Fahima Patricia Seck, who's a friend of WBAI, for sending me the speech early this morning. This is also the day that Congress is supposed to certify the votes of the Electoral College, the final arbiters of Joe Biden's win to the presidency of the United States. And the vice president is charged with the task of presiding over this joint session of Congress. But some Republicans have laid plans to object to the election results, and these include Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, and I think nine others. In a tweet, Trump said that he believes Pence should overturn the election results in some states by rejecting the chosen electors of those states. The president claimed incorrectly that Pence, quote, has the power to reject fraudulently chosen electors. But the Constitution does not grant the vice president such a power in what is largely a ceremonial role. But Pence is going along with the circus, and he's essentially said that he welcomes the effort of members of the House and Senate to use the authority they have under the law to raise objections and bring forward evidence before the Congress and the American people today. Meanwhile, Trump is expected to speak at 11 a.m. at his to his supporters, the Proud Boys, and others at a protest of the election results in Washington, D.C. So this is what's happening, folks, in American society. We have a polarization, a political polarization. Winners in Georgia, a descendant of enslaved Africans, and white supremacists marching in Washington, D.C. Here to help us understand this strange political moment, we welcome Douglas Medina to the show. Professor Medina joined the faculty of CUNY's Gutman Community College in September 2019 as an instructor of political and social sciences. He is a PhD candidate in the political science program at the CUNY Graduate Center, and he holds an MA in liberal studies from the New School and an MPhil in the political science department at the CUNY Graduate Center. Professor Medina, welcome to A New Day.
Thank you so much, Johanna, and good morning and Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Thank you so very much. Happy New Year. So what are your initial reactions to this morning's news?
Oh, so many reactions. And I have to tell you, in politics nowadays, we have to take any good news that we can get. So the fact that Warnock, when I woke up, had actually captured the Senate seat is definitely good news. Last time I checked, about an hour ago, he was leading by over 53,000 votes. And that margin is expected to grow. In fact, they're reporting that by Friday, we'll know for sure after they've counted all the ballots, especially the overseas ballots. In terms of Ossoff, it looks like he has a razor-thin margin, leading by about 16,000 votes. So that's also good news, and everything's pointing towards him winning because the remaining districts that are yet to be counted are leaning Democratic. So certainly this is good news, but I also have to tell you, I may be at the margins here, but I'm not as excited about the Democrats potentially capturing the Senate with 50 seats and Kamala Harris being the tiebreaker in the Senate. The reason for this, Johanna, is because let's think back in history to about 12, 13 years ago when Barack Hussein Obama was elected president. And if you recall, he was elected with a mandate for change, right? And he actually had both the Senate and the House in his pocket. And certainly we can probably go into that, but look how that turned out, right? In fact, I would argue, and I may get some heat from some people for saying this, but I would argue that we have to look at Obama's presidency, his two terms, to really understand how we got Trump. So that's just in terms of the Georgia election. Now, in terms of Trump, you know, when you look at Trump, we got exactly what we expected and who he told us he was going to be, the kind of president he was going to be. Fundamentally, Trump is a political opportunist, a narcissist, a blowhard. You know, you can go down the list in terms of his character flaws. But fundamentally, he knows how to use the media. And in fact, I think he changed the way the media covers presidencies. And in many ways, you can also argue that he actually bypassed the regular channels, no pun intended, in terms of communicating with the public and specifically with his base. I mean, the fact that he could use Twitter and then Twitter became the actual news story about what Trump said, the latest insult he threw at another politician. He mastered that, right? So when you look at what he's doing now, clearly he's trying to stage a coup. And I think you reported on the phone call that he made to the chair of the elections board in Georgia, Brad. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce his last name, but it's clear that he is trying to make something happen. Now, there are some good news in terms of that. Number one, I don't think
but
that the
let's,
ruling
before
class...
But before we go to Trump, let's stay on the Senate race.
Sure.
And what this would mean for policies in this country that might improve the living conditions of ordinary people. What is expected is that the Democrats, if they win, will send $2,000 to every American amidst pandemic. So we can't overlook that. That could potentially happen. However, as you suggested, let's look at everything that has happened before. And that's the Obama presidency. Obama had pretty much carte blanche to pass health care for all, and he whittled it down to essentially appeal to the right and to Republicans, and then that went up in smoke. So that's
correct.
What we know. So tell us more about that. Tell us more even about what you know of Raphael Warnock, because when I heard him say that he is the son of a minister and small business owner in the South, those are the politics of conservative black folks or middle of the road black folks. And that's only one person. Are the interests of the politicians we elect to Congress and to the Senate the interests of the people at the bottom of society?
I would like to say yes, but I'm a bit cynical about this. I mean, this race in particular was one of the most expensive races for Senate in the history of the United States. Now, yes, I do believe that Warnock, I mean, I don't know what's in his heart. I don't know whether he's being honest or not. And I do, what I do know about his background is based on, you know, reports and what he himself has said. And he has said, absolutely, to reiterate what you said, and Biden has said the same thing, that if we get these two seats in Georgia, he will do his best. Warnock and Biden will do their best to actually make sure that Americans get a $2,000 check. So that's good news. That's certainly good news. Now, when you look at the actual platform that Warnock ran under, he is actually running under improving Obamacare, the ACA. he's not calling for Medicare for all. And personally speaking, I think that should be one of the litmus tests, not only for any senator who's running, but any politician nowadays. If there's anything that is more pressing now, is right. Of course the pandemic and healthcare. In fact, some have observed that when you look at the failures of the rollout and how few people are actually being vaccinated, they attribute it to the fact that we don't have a national government-sponsored, government-paid healthcare system. I was listening to somebody talk about this on CNN. Of all places, the mainstream news media is finally acknowledging, you know what, maybe having a national healthcare system would be a good idea. So the bureaucratic blocks behind the rollout and getting people vaccinated is part of the problem, right? And I mentioned this because Warnock has basically said, yeah, okay, you know, we should improve Obamacare, but what about Medicare for all? Now, and when you look at the makeup of the Senate as well, I mean, these are, most of them are millionaires, by the way. I don't know about Warnock's wealth. I don't know about Ossoff's wealth. But fundamentally, the Senate is probably the least democratic institution in American politics.
Yes.
Again, you know, I don't want to be too pessimistic about this, but I also think that we need to keep our expectations in check in terms of what actually happens once Biden gets into office. And in terms of Medicare for all and healthcare for everyone, remember, Biden has explicitly said, if I get a bill for Medicare for all on my desk, I will veto it. So, I mean, it's really difficult to be optimistic. At the same time, I do think that this is not only the pandemic, but Trump's presidency has been a catalyst for a lot of people to actually become involved. In fact, in Georgia, when you look at people between the ages of 18 and 35, there was a major bump, a major increase in the people who registered to vote and who came out to vote during the presidential election in November. And I have yet to see the demographics and the breakdown of people who voted in the runoff election. But I would imagine that a lot of young people actually came out to vote. So in that sense, I think people are realizing that, hey, there's something wrong. There's something rotten in Denmark, and we need to do something about it.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Professor Douglas Medina about the senatorial win this morning, historic, but also about the character of this political moment. Professor Medina is instructor of political and social sciences at CUNY's Gutman Community College. And you're listening to WBAI in New York City. And we're going to take callers a little later on, so you might want to grab this number, 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. It's my understanding, Douglas, that
yes.
The Latino vote was pivotal in Georgia, and Latinos are disproportionately young. So it's the children of immigrants, the
right.
immigrants who built the Olympic stadiums in 1996, who then stayed there. It's the children of those workers, super exploited workers, who voted and who are angry and who want change. But how is it that change happens in American society? Has it happened through the electoral process?
Well, I think it's a combination of both the electoral process, but also outside pressure from social movements. And of course, I don't have to tell you that the civil rights movement is probably emblematic of this point. Now, in terms of what I would call identity politics, and whenever anyone brings up the question of either the Black vote, the Latino vote, the Asian vote, I am forced to mention the fact that there is no Latino vote, there is no Black vote, for the simple reason that people vote based on their material class interests. So, for example, when you look at the way that the presidential election voting returns looked in Texas and in Florida, there were many Latinos who actually voted for Trump. In Texas, near the border of, in the district near the border of Mexico, there were a lot of Latinos who voted for Trump. At the same time, there are a lot of Blacks who voted for Trump. So again, we can go down the list. So I think what's more useful is to talk about what were people's interests, or what did they think they were voting for and against when they voted for either Trump or Biden. Now, in terms of Georgia, Georgia is a really interesting case because, as you know, it's been voting Republican since 1992. And it was a very special coalition of white, moderate, suburban individuals who basically were the coalition that voted Trump into, that voted Biden into office. Now, it's interesting because when you look at the polls, and when you look at the way that the vote broke down, you see that a lot of people actually voted for Biden, but then down ballot, they split their ticket and they voted for Republicans. So that is a very, very shaky foundation to build your political coalition with. So I, you know, when political scientists tell you they can predict the future, you know, run away, run fast, because we're good at predicting stuff that already happened. But take this with a grain of salt. You know, I think the next 4 years are going to be very telling in terms of who the Democratic Party is, what they stand for, and whether they're going to come around to actually doing a postmortem on how Hillary Clinton lost. That has not happened. In fact, I would also argue that the Democratic Party has been peddling conspiracy theories, especially when you look at Russiagate, to explain why they have lost and why Republicans are winning and why specifically Trump won. We have to take a step back and look at who actually makes up the Democratic Party, which is essentially a neoliberal party, right?
So let's let us then shift, because I think that assessment that the Democrats won lost for a reason, and that the Democrats' neoliberal policies essentially have laid the groundwork for what's happening today in Washington D.C. Right, yes. This rise or not rise of white supremacists, it's an unveiling of white supremacy in this country. Can you give us a sense of what you think is happening in Washington D.C. and why? What is behind this circus? Is this some last-ditch effort on the part of the president to save face and avoid the embarrassment of failure? Or is there something else at work? Or is there something different happening in Washington and over the course of the last 4 years?
Yeah. Joanna, I think you actually characterized it very accurately when you said it's a circus. I think that's precisely what it is. When you look at Trump's presidency, again, going back to what I mentioned before about how he uses the media, and I think that what he's doing right now is actually in line with what he has been doing in the past 4 years, which is essentially to sow chaos and to get his base riled up. That's what this is about. But he's also sending a message. I think this is my interpretation of what's actually happening behind the scenes. Because he wants to send a message to the ruling classes that, hey, I'm not going to go easily. You need to at least consider giving me some space to stage this coup. And I am going to do it through violent means, through getting my base riled up, through telling lies, through dishonest accusations, and everything that comes along with that. Trump is being Trump, essentially. Now, the actual demonstration is a circus. And when you look at the makeup of the different movements that are going to be showing up, you also have to look specifically about what they represent. So, for example, you have the Proud Boys. And I was just looking at the news, I think yesterday, Enrique Tarrio, who's the chairman of the Proud Boys, was arrested because he was burning BLM signs at a church in Washington. Now, when you look at this character, right, who is Enrique Tarrio? Enrique Tarrio identifies, listen to this, as an Afro-Cuban. He was born in Little Havana. And, I mean, I would imagine that he has ties to the Gusanos who are in Florida, to the people who are fighting against the Cuban government. So, and, you know, he actually also ran for Congress in Florida. He lost, thankfully, but this guy is a political operative. He may come across, and by the way, he has also said in his own words, I am not a white supremacist. I am not a racist. Look at me. I am, you know, I am one of you. I am Latino black, you know. So, and that's where I think the analysis that uses identity politics breaks down, because then we need to explain that. My way of explaining that is that you have to look at the purposes that these movements serve. Now, in all fairness, of course, it's going to attract individuals who, you know, are racist, who are white supremacists, who believe in a race war. I mean, after all, that's where the term comes from, right? Boogaloo. By the way, funny story. I remember the first time I heard the term Boogaloo Boys about, what, a year, year and a half ago. And I remember thinking, oh, man, this is great. Finally, Latino culture is getting its due attention, because Boogaloo, for those of you who follow Latin music, was a very popular form of music and dance in the 1960s. And in fact, I've taken classes in Boogaloo. So I'm like, oh, geez, I wonder if I know the people who are performing in this Boogaloo Boys group. And to my dismay, it turned out to be this, right? So the point here is that it is a show. It is a circus. It is a way of Trump sending a message to the ruling elite that, hey, listen, pay attention to me. I'm not going to go easily. You need to help me out here. It is his last gasp, I think. But more importantly, this is the last thing I'll say, forget the demonstration. You know what we have to pay attention to? A potential attack on Iran. There are reports that some naval exercises are being conducted in the Gulf near Iran. So we have to pay attention to that. I would not be surprised, Joanna, if he pulls that off the day before the inauguration of Joe Biden as president.
You're listening to the voice of Professor Douglas Medina, and we're talking about this political moment and what Trump represents, his base, the Boogaloo Boys, but also the meaning of the senatorial victory this morning. I'm Johanna Fernandez, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, and we'd like to take callers. The number to call is 212-209-2877. We have time for a call or two. 212-209-2877. Tell us what you think about this moment and what is happening in Washington, D.C. Now, I agree with your assessment. And Venezuela is also a potential target in this period, and they've been trying to intervene, and the United States is actively in a process of intervention through third parties since the summer. Mm-hmm. But I want to get a sense from you of what's the meaning of this unveiling of militia groups and white supremacists, because it's not it's not an isolated incident. We have 10% in 10% of American counties, there are active and growing white supremacist groups. So can you give us a sense of what is it that is fueling these politics in the United States?
Well, I think it's Trump. I mean, you mentioned this before, the polarization of the electorate for the past 20 years. I think that people are becoming more ideologically rigid in terms of what they believe. And I think ultimately it's fueled by the past 40 years of neoliberal policies that have put a stranglehold on the working class primarily. And of course, it has enriched the people who are already wealthy. I'm sure that you caught the headlines of some 500 billionaires have more than doubled, and in some instances, tripled their wealth.
Their wealth. Douglas, Walmart, go ahead, finish that statement.
Walmart and Amazon being two of the most egregious cases. So I think that fundamentally it is the economic and the social despair that people are experiencing that's bringing them back into the streets and promoting their vicious ideas.
We have a number of callers. Let's keep our comments brief. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from. Caller.
Am I on?
You are on.
Okay. Hi. I'm Marilyn from Brooklyn. Wonderful program, Johanna. And I wanted to commend your guests for bringing up the issue of an upcoming attack on Iran, because it's bothered me all throughout this period of the elections that the focus of the major media and everything is on the elections, and there are so many other things going on, particularly the preparations for attacks on Iran. And the media has been covering, the papers have been covering the terrible devastation still in Iraq because they don't have any, because the United States destroyed the electricity grid back in 2003, the water purification systems, and the jobs are gone. I mean, one poor young man who had an engineering degree was in the street selling junk, and he just said, "This is a graveyard. I live in a graveyard." And imperialism wants to make Iran and Venezuela graveyards too, like they have done in the past to other countries. And
thank you, Marilyn, for those comments. Appreciate your call. We have a number of other callers, and it's 7:52, and you're listening to WBAI New York. Thanks for the call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yes, good morning. This is Lynn from New Jersey. And I'm glad your guest has brought up that having Democrats doesn't make everything look sunny. It's very frustrating. I've been a lifelong Democrat, but I may go independent. So the Democrats have, definitely a lot of good policies, but they have some horrible policies. They want to push this vaccine, which is definitely not safe or effective. Vaccine needs to be tested on animals for at least 3 or 4 years. So Pfizer has decided we're going to be the animals. And we're going to trust a company with no outside evaluator to tell us their product is safe and effective that they whipped up in 2 months, an mRNA-type vaccine that basically will alter our DNA. This has never been done.
Lynn, thank you so very much.
The Democrats that are pushing this. It's terrible.
Thank you. We're going to take... No, we can't take another caller. Maybe we can. Caller, if you keep it short, 20 seconds. Caller, you're on the line, your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, it's Russ. I noticed that Trump gave McConnell a kick on his way out the door, and now Democrats are going to have trillions of dollars of debt, and the austerity will be enforced by them. I'd like to ask your guest, is it okay now that we're going to go back and forth between Republicans and Democrats? Thanks.
Thank you, Ross. Okay, we've got about 3 minutes left. Douglas.
Yes. Well, to your last caller, I mean, the two parties are essentially the party of the ruling elite, right? And I think I can say that on your show. I think that Bernie Sanders really did open up a space for us to have a conversation about public goods and what that means and government's responsibility to provide for the needs of the public, for the public. And it's not surprising, by the way, that he ran under the Democratic Party ticket, because that's the only way to get some mainstream media attention to the problems that everyone's facing. And of course, when you look at the media, it is a privately funded, privately run enterprise and institution. So we're not going to get a lot of discussions like we're having now here on your program, Johanna. So fundamentally, I think this is an opportunity. I think moments of crises are opportunities for learning, for teaching, and for really talking about issues that affect all of us, particularly the working class. So I'm hoping that I'm thankful that we have shows like yours, because this is, again, a space and an avenue for us to have broader discussions about how to move forward.
You've been listening to the voice of Professor Douglas Medina. I'm Johanna Fernandez, and you're listening to WBAI in New York. This is A New Day. Douglas, thank you so very much for your insightful analysis. I think we need to have you back on the show pronto, like immediately.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, literally in the next 2 weeks, we're going to want to bring you back so that you can help us analyze January 20th.
Sure. Sounds good.
You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:56 and 37 degrees in Central Park this morning. We'll see a high near 42, and it will be mostly sunny this Wednesday, January 6th, 2021. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day in 2021. Thank you for tuning in. This show is produced by Ajamo Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, Andrea Hidalgo, Marcos Maldonado, and Craig Bahia. Michael G. Haskins is holding it down as our board operator. And we leave you with A Midnight Train to Georgia. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in. Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Too much for the man.
Too much for the man. He couldn't make it.
So he's leaving the life he's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going.
He said he's going back. The world he left behind not so long ago. He's leaving,
leaving
on that midnight train to Georgia.
Leaving on the midnight train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Said he's going back.
Going back
to a simpler place and time. Oh, yes. But he so found out the hard way that dreams don't always come true. Oh no, So he burned all his hopes, and even so,
tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI in New York.